Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. Over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you are tuning in live or catching the podcast later, please stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers and key newsmakers. It is everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp and straight to the point. It's Friday, the 25th of October. Coming up on the program, the Gauteng Local Government Turnaround Summit. Is there a workable plan or just lots of hot air? Why television viewing is starting to increase, an expert view on the 2025 salary landscape, and a rainbow chicken food safety scare. I'll talk to the chief executive. Over the past couple of days, the Gauteng Local Government Turnaround Summit has been focusing on how municipalities plan to address their financial difficulties and also decaying infrastructure. I don't need to tell you that delays and cost overruns have plagued these projects, particularly in coalition-run areas. Joining us now is Jacob Mamabolo, who's MEC for Infrastructure and Development, as well as Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs in the province. MEC, welcome to you. I'm interested to know exactly how official are being held accountable for the collapse of their municipalities, given that wasteful expenditure continues to rise into the billions every year in spite of policies in place.
Firstly, let me greet you and all the listeners. Let me thank you for inviting us, and maybe as a starting point, just to confirm to the listeners that indeed yesterday we concluded a two-day very groundbreaking Gauteng Local Government Turnaround Summit, well attended and with very high quality discussions. The issue relating to consequence management in municipalities came out very strongly, and it was one of the most important recommendations that as the province of Gauteng, it is very much important that we engage with the municipal public account committees so that they can be able to make sure that the due process clearly stipulated in the law is followed to bring matters that relate to unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, so that council can deal with those matters, ensure that there are hearings. So to deal with that issue, we need to precisely make sure that we conduct consistent and ongoing oversight on the performance of the MPEC committees so that these matters can be dealt with within the framework of the law.
So, Minister, that is good news to hear, but who's directly responsible then for enforcing these accountability measures that you're talking about, and perhaps more importantly, what consequences are in place for those who fail to deliver results?
So, firstly, the council as a sphere of government itself, it's actually its mandate, but secondly, ourselves as the provincial government, we conduct oversight on the performance of all structures in municipalities, and we will be making sure that we not only train councillors and new councillors that are coming in, but I think one of the major weaknesses in the system has been precisely consistent, without fear or favor, monitoring. I think an evaluation of these committees, because we are also equally interested in making sure that we don't breach or undermine the procedures that have to be followed, because otherwise consequence management will not happen. People will walk scot-free. So the issue here is really providing monitoring, evaluation, leadership, focus, and making sure that we get regular reports on the performance of the committees and the councils, so that when the MPEC committees are done, these matters must find their way into council meetings.
MEC, let me ask you this. First of all, what consequences are in place for those who fail to deliver results? That was the second part of my question, which you haven't answered.
Well, the laws stipulate various consequences, in the sense that once the investigations are done and there's a need now to refer matters to the established disciplinary committees and structures of council, they will then determine what is the most appropriate sanction for those that are found to have caused irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure.
MEC, let me ask you this question as well. Given all the political squabbling that exists in so many councils here in Gauteng, how can you be confident that the councils are going to deliver on that oversight mandate?
Well, let me concede the point that there is a weakness that I think we mustn't, fail to mention, because it is an important weakness. There is a well-researched criticism about, how these committees are structured, created, and of course the fact that they made up of, they have to go back to the speaker, the mayor, the chief whips, to be able to get their work through. So there is that limitation. But as I'm saying to you, the best way to deal with this matter and make sure that it's dealt with properly is by oversight, getting reports, making follow-ups, and making sure that we can be able to even get reports on where the disciplinary processes have gone.
MEC, would it not be better, rather, to deal with those limitations that you have just conceded?
Remember, there is an amendment in the law to make sure that we deal with the challenges relating to coalitions, to leadership instability, to management instability as well in municipalities as a result of the political landscape that is brought upon us by coalition. So there is a bill that is currently before Parliament. It will bring stability, and I'm quite sure that with that, we should be able to deal with this issue of how political instability brought upon by coalitions impact the proper functioning of municipalities. And that's why we need a law. It is out of a recognition that governance in municipalities is impacted upon by the problems that are there coming out of the new reality of coalitions. And that's why it has to be managed through the mechanism of the law.
Let's move away from oversight now. Given, MEC, the decaying infrastructure highlighted in that declaration, what is the projected cost of reversing this decay, and how are you going to make sure that these projects remain on budget?
One of the most important things that we have acknowledged as the provincial government is that the coordination between ourselves as a province and municipalities and national government on infrastructure delivery is very critical. For example, I'm now the MEC responsible for infrastructure development and local government at a political level. That gives us the opportunity to ensure efficient and effective coordination between the capacities that sits in the provincial government and to augment and support those in the municipalities.
MEC, with respect, I asked you to put a number to it. What is the projected cost of reversing this decay? What kind of numbers can you wrap around the problem?
Let me just say to you and the listeners that I don't have the cost of that with me now. But at this point, we know that the whole province spends about, is allocated in this financial year, municipalities and province combined about 43 billion to spend on infrastructure. But we have not calculated the cost of what will it take to reverse the current distress, failure, abandoned, incomplete projects across the length and breadth of our municipalities in the province. And that's exactly an exercise that needs to be done. And that's why we have unveiled last week, Thursday, a smart platform that we call Infrastructure Delivery Platform, which will extend to municipalities precisely to have the right level of data and information that will be able to help us, including quantifying the cost itself of failed infrastructure and even the shortfalls that we need in order to correct that. So we have started a new approach of data-driven, data-centered project management precisely because the data, even by the way, before we even go to the rents and cent of the cost of failure in projects, just the total number of projects we are managing, where are they? Are they sufficiently budgeted? What is the actual shortfall on this project? So that type of data is currently not coordinated at the right level to help us to make appropriate interventions. And that's precisely what we want to deal with, to have proper data and information to make decisions and to inform the public and to be able to make appropriate interventions.
All right. MEC Jacob Mamabolo, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, what can we expect from salary increases in the coming year? According to Dr. Mark Bewson, Master Rewards Specialist and Executive Committee Member of the South African Rewards Association, South Africans can look forward to an average salary increase of around 6% next year. But what does this really mean in terms of keeping up with inflation and improving quality of life? He joins me on the program now. And Dr. Bewson, first of all, 6% is the projection, but with inflation currently at around 4.4%, does this really provide a meaningful increase for employees who are dealing with rising living costs?
From a technical point of view, we can say that a few percent above inflation is good. From a real point of view, in other words, the person who is getting that interview, they think inflation is 10, 20%, so they don't think it's a good interview. So I guess it depends what lens you're on. I'm with the people on this one. I think that inflation is higher than that, or the CPI is higher than that, and folk are getting systematically poorer.
And Mark, you talk about this concept called in-work poverty, which many workers still live in. So I guess the question is how far these increases go in addressing the gap between a minimum wage and what you've also termed a true living wage.
I think it goes some way because it's more than inflation, but not enough. And if you take the minimum wage, I understand the tightrope that we walk in. The tightrope is jobs, and we want to keep jobs. So I want to put in the caveat that jobs is more important than a minimum or a living wage in my view. But for those that can, we need to move towards the living wage, which is more like 12,500 rand per month for an average worker in an average geography in South Africa. So we do need to move quicker towards that living wage. It gives dignity, and 1 or 2% above inflation, it's moving in the right direction. So the directional information is fine, but the reality is it's too little.
The point is absolutely taken, Mark, but you'll also agree with me that salary increases are always influenced by a variety of factors. So the challenge for any employer is to balance competing pressures while ensuring business sustainability. I would suggest to you that is becoming more and more difficult.
It is, Jeremy, and that's why we pay our CEOs so well. They need to manage this, and they need to make sure that they get the balance right. And it depends what lens you're on. The shareholder wants more and more and more from the poor companies and the poor CEOs managing them and leading them. And the workers want it. So it is exactly right. The ham in the sandwich. And it is about balance, but they get paid very well and very fairly in my view. So they should try and make it happen.
You also point out that your data shows a lower increase for executives and chief executive officers compared to unionized and general staff. What do you think the philosophy, Mark, is behind that? Are we seeing now a deliberate shift to address income inequality, or simply a reflection of existing market trends?
I think it's a very, very deliberate shift to narrowing the wage gap. So if you're narrowing it by 1 or 2% like that, it's not enough. The gap between the lowest paid and the highest paid needs to be significantly more than that, but it's very deliberate, and it has been like that for a few years. So directionally, again, we're moving in the right direction.
Mark, the role of salary increases, though, within the broader context of a total reward program is also critical. And this is the world that you work in. It's not just about the salary. It's as much about the comprehensive package beyond just the salary hike. What changes, trends, moves are you witnessing in that direction?
The single biggest one is this move towards more flexible work, more time out, and wellness. So the best example I can come up with is in China. Very recently, someone won the lottery of 1 year's paid leave. It's radical things like that that I think we need to start thinking about. And if I had a magic wand, I would put wellness management in the CEO's KPAs and KPIs to the tune of 10 or 15%. So it's okay getting profits, but not at the expense of wellness. So wellness is a big benefit. And again, a massive trend in the United States is that people would move companies because of a better medical aid. In our country, we would never do that. There'd have to be quite a lot more money. But people in America with cash neutral fixed pay would move because of better benefits in terms of medical aid. So the medical aid costs and the medical aid expenses are rising disproportionately quicker to our pay increases, and most people are paying a lot more attention to that now.
Mark, I love this idea of winning the year's paid leave, but it's a difficult one because of talent shortage. And we do have a skill shortage in this country. So it's also important, you'll tell me, for companies to align salary increases with talent retention, particularly for key roles and critical skills. Again, that's another conundrum that business leaders have to face.
Indeed. So there are several structural ways that we can fix it. One is our hiring practices. Sometimes the recruitment bar is just too high, and someone who's 80% there should be given a shot. And I think there's more than enough skill in our country to do that. So that's the first change I'd love to see. The second one is from the government side, Home Affairs. Make it a lot easier to bring folk in when we need the skills. I know we're short of anaesthetists. So instead of getting an international anaesthetist, we'd rather have a hospital with no anaesthetist, which it's incomprehensible to me as to why one would do that. So there are some really, really easy fixes beyond just the pay. To retain top talent, it's mostly about inspirational leadership. And if I had R1 million, I'd spend 3/4 of it on inspirational leadership and 1/4 of it fixing the pay.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you very much indeed. A lot of food for thought, Dr. Mark Buesen. Appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now this week, concerns around food safety have resurfaced following a public inspection at the Devland Cash and Carry here in Gauteng, where issues with Rainbow Chicken's individually quick frozen products have been identified. Specifically, packaging for some products lacked visible expiry dates. That did raise questions about food safety protocols as well as accountability. Joining me now is Martina Stunder, who's Chief Executive Officer of Rainbow Chicken. And first of all then, what specific breakdown in the system allowed this chicken to be sold without the expiry date showing?
No, Jeremy, the situation is pretty simple. There's an inkjet printer process that puts the individual date codes on the bag. So we immediately went in and inspected, and we opened 2,040 bags, and we found 28 of those. That's at that Devlin Cash and Carry. Yep. And of those 2,040, 28 were not coded. So it's a mistake. It's an error. It's unfortunate. It's 28 too many. It's 1.37% of those that we tested. You can say it's a compliance of 98.6%, but in our world, it is a failure. It is 28 that were not coded. The outside bags, in other words, you have these individual bags and they go in the Hessian type of outer bag. All the outer bags were date coded. But in that case, we did find 28 that were non-compliant.
What would have happened had someone eaten them?
No, it's absolutely nothing, because it is not stock that is out of date. So all the other bags comes from the same batch, same production date, same shift with traceability. So those were just part of the bigger batch. So that's not a case of stock that was, you know, out of date or out of best before or sell-by date. It was merely an error that those were not printed.
Of course, it does raise the question, doesn't it, about how often these packaging systems are reviewed and why this lapse wasn't caught before the product reached consumers.
Absolutely. So we have a QA process. We have stringent controls. But, you know, you can now say what you want, and it still means 28 slip through. It is an environment which is semi-wet, and you can now imagine each bag is not a square thing. It contains portions. So it is not an easy process, but it should not have happened. We have a process of checking those. And what it means is a little bit back to the drawing board on that. There will be retraining. It's an honest mistake in our view, in the sense of, you know, you can go into a disciplinary process, but we will conduct investigations in the plants. We've already done those. And it's a matter of correction, you know, corrective measures.
Are you able to guarantee that no other stores have similar issues with your IQF products? Are you able to give an assurance that this isn't a widespread problem?
No, Jeremy, I don't think one can do that. What we have done is we're working with our partners, in other words, our customers, and with this occurrence of, you know, 1.37%, we accessed 6 out of 23 pallets at that specific store. The others were just so packed that we couldn't access. But we're continuing that, and then we've put all customers on alert, because there is also, call it a shared responsibility, when the product is put on shelf. Or let us say they can help us as our partners to alert us if any such case, you know, happens. But within the bigger bag, where that bag comes out of, all the date coding is in place, all the product is within the date spec by a long shot. So there's no food safety concern on this. It is a quality issue, but nonetheless shouldn't have happened.
How were you first alerted to the problem?
We became aware on social media that the MCC visited Devlin, and then you know, we picked up that there were mention of Rainbow, and obviously immediately got our attention. We were out there as soon as we could, which was 8 o'clock in the morning of the 23rd. We heard of it in the afternoon of the 22nd.
Do you think that people have overreacted to this issue?
No, you know, it's absolutely right. As you said in the beginning, you don't want to deal with these things, but we appreciate scrutiny and control measures, and if something's not right, we want to set it right.
Are you talking to Devlin Cash and Carry about actions that they need to take in order to make sure that this doesn't happen again? Within that broader supply chain, should they have perhaps picked it up a little bit earlier, or is it not part of their remit?
No, as I said, Jeremy, we consider our customers our partners in this case. So it's merely a request from our side to be alert. We now know there were a number of bags that slipped through, and we'll appreciate if they look at those individual bags and other customers as well, as I said. And we'll monitor the situation and see if there's a wider spread of it. We, of course, have 3 big processing plants. In this case, it was the Rustenburg plant. So it also means we are checking all over the system. But you have an inkjet print. It automatically prints as the bag goes past, prints on it. As I said, sometimes there's, you know, the bag is wet and it's difficult, but in general, they are made for those situations. They must be presented by the conveyor in such a fashion that the printer can print on it. So we will see, as I said, a little bit of going back to that drawing board, see if we can improve and get that hit rate up. The outside bags, those bags are then put into big bags that are sealed, and these bigger bags are then stacked onto the pallets. So there's the pallet, there's traceability from there, there's a traceability from the outer bag, but we need to give the individual consumer who buys one such IQF bag the assurance that that date code can be seen.
And that is absolutely critical. And this is a final question to you. Do you believe that you have a consumer confidence problem here, or do you think that you've resolved the issue sufficiently?
No, I don't think we have a consumer confidence problem. It's massive amounts. We slaughter 4.5 million chickens per week, and it's 400,000 tons. I'm not trying to just get the right number. But the point is, it is a. I'm trying to give you an annual number, but the point is, there is a lot of chicken that goes through our factory, and we have confidence that we do absolutely our level best to assure that everything goes right. In this case, an error occurred, so I don't think we're dealing with a bigger confidence issue.
Martinus Stander, Chief Executive, Rainbow Chicken Limited. Thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. All right, this is our final story on this Friday. With load shedding having a huge impact on our daily lives, television viewership in South Africa has also been feeling the strain. But with the lights now staying on, we are seeing a comeback for television, according to the Marketing Research Foundation's latest MAPS survey. It says there has been a slight recovery in viewership. I'm in conversation now with Johan Koster, who is CEO of the MRF. And first of all then, Johan, how significant is this recovery trend? Is it a longer term or maybe just a bounce?
I think, in our view, it is quite significant because, we've been trying to quantify exactly what the impact of load shedding has been on media consumption in general. And now with the easing of load shedding, we're seeing it's about a 8% bounce in population numbers, population penetration that we're seeing as a result of this. And that, it equates to close to probably about 3 million, 3.5 million people who now more regularly accessing television. So it's quite significant.
There are still bigger factors, though, Johan, holding TV viewership back. If you look, if you compare it to, say, 2021 and previously, even though load shedding is now longer a daily issue, what do you think the other factors are then?
We've been seeing a general shift in consumer behavior. It's quite seismic, actually. There's the uptake of online content, right? Streaming, social media, and the like, that is driving consumers across different platforms. So, in the good old days, we had radio, television, and print, and those were your mainstays as far as media is concerned. It's become a lot more complex, and the consumers, they're spoiled for choice. So they distributing their activity across media types in a typical day. So I think that's a challenge for television, is to maintain their audiences with competition such as streaming services, Netflix, Showmax and the like. And then there's also technical issues that are curbing or hindering television uptake. There's government is migrating all the terrestrial television signals from an analog system to a digital system. And for that digital system to work in your house, you need a little set-top box and maybe a different antenna as well on your roof. So that process is still happening, and it's not been managed that well. So we did see television lose quite a few households, significant numbers of households, actually, in those provinces that have been migrated, because they just didn't have the equipment in place. So there's a lag in that process. Television signals get switched off, and then they realize, oops, I don't have signal anymore, and then they go out and they try and fix the problem. And not everyone can, of course, afford satellite and satellite boxes and subscription services. So they're dependent on these three television services coming in through the old traditional means.
Well, Johan, let's talk about those streaming platforms then. You have Netflix and Showmax, which are probably the principal two in South Africa. Your data, the MAPS data, shows a steady increase. Is this rise going to continue, do you think, to affect traditional TV's ability to compete for viewers, or is the race almost over at this point?
No, not at all. Television is still very powerful. There's over 70 just close to 70% of the population who report that they watch TV at least, you know, 1 hour a week of television. So it's still very powerful. It's got a very strong and deep penetration into the population, where the streaming services are more around 20 to 25% of the population. So there's steady growth with the likes of Netflix and Showmax, but they're nowhere near the penetration levels of television. So the fight's definitely on. It's about, you know, share of viewing, share of eyeballs. And, you know, that fight, I think, will intensify. But most of these broadcasters have also diversified in terms of their strategy. So a lot of them also now offer streaming services, SABC Plus, Prime Media Plus, EVOT for ETV, DSTV Stream. So they've recognized that there is this need to diversify and also try and catch that streaming audience as well. So I think it's a battle that will rage for a while.
And interestingly, do you think that that's having any impact? So these traditional terrestrial channels who have now put a toe into the streaming pool, obviously they had no choice, but are they making any inroads at all, do you think?
I think they do. You know, I think there's significant numbers of audiences that are moving to online platforms, especially depending on the business model of the typical of the broadcaster in question. If those services are free, I think their uptake will be a lot quicker. The hindrance with online and streaming, of course, is data costs. So, you know, the households at the bottom end of the market can't necessarily afford the kind of data that's required to stream content. So they would still be reliant on traditional television, free signals and the like. Mm. So I think there's a saturation point or some kind of balance point that we will reach where, you know, what is affordable to households dictates how much free television, traditional television they use versus kind of streaming services and being dictated by data cost and affordability.
What I find utterly fascinating is the second screen phenomenon. So there's agreement that TV remains a powerful platform for advertising. It will continue to be so, as you've suggested. But here's the interesting bit of data that you've pointed out. Let's call it 40% of viewers also engaging on social media while watching television. Is there now a shift in the way brands are either approaching or need to approach cross-platform engagement?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a need to shift. I think many brands have already recognized it and have made this shift. I think there's an opportunity there to have engagement with audiences and consumers across multiple platforms. So the kind of content you would put on television might start a conversation that you then continue in social media, you know, and that might be driven by a specific brand or topic, you know, whatever. And I think the strategy there needs to be good and clever, because engagement with the audiences need to be, you know, it needs to be authentic, and it's not always easy to get that mix right. But yeah, there's radio used to be, the interesting thing is radio used to be the companion medium in the background. That's always, you know, the second biggest medium in use, but that's clearly shifted to social media and online activity. So it is fascinating to see how that behavior has changed around television viewing while you're on social media. I don't know how people get that right. I can barely keep my attention on one thing, but yeah, there you go.
You're talking to the converted. I agree with you. But nonetheless, it is a phenomenon. Johan Koster, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of the Marketing Research Foundation in discussion on the latest MAPS survey. Appreciate your time. Thank you very much. On the last poll that we ran, I asked you about South African Airways claiming to be debt-free, and I asked if you believe it. 5% of our respondents said yes, thanks to better management, 42% saying pie in the sky, and a 53% saying check the numbers. And on our poll today, South Africans can look forward to an average salary increase of around 6% next year, according to one of our guests on the program. Is that about right or too optimistic a view? You can participate either on our LinkedIn or X feeds. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.